international finance law. We want to understand the nature and operation of the principal international finance markets in the world. I have provided a key document which explains all of the core markets and the structure and operation of all of the key issues that we are looking at. That's the introduction to international finance markets law and practice. This will be the basis for my book in this area, with a large number of other separate chapters separately provided. I've also made available a separate study pack which explains how we can break all this down and examine this and study this in terms of each of the particular markets or sets of core areas of legal and market practice that arise. With regards to the study pack, we will see that we're going to look at introduction to international capital markets and investment banking, structure, operation and regulation. All of that is then developed in the paper on the right-hand side. It looks at the history of banking and finance, banking, international finance, international trade and merchant finance, merchant banking, investment banking. Commercial banking is accepting deposits and advancing credit on funds. It's taking deposits, pooling them, and then on lending them. This involves what we call maturity transformation and maturity mismatch. The point is that the banks fund themselves short or on site, on demand, and then lend medium to long term. That's what creates the fundamental risk in the banking market. So the commercial banks do deposit taking and lending. An investment bank is an accident of American legal English. It was the term that was adopted after the Glass-Steagall provisions of the Banking Act 1933, which separated commercial and investment activities in the United States after the Wall Street collapse in 1929. One of the considerations, one of the concerns that had arisen was that deposit funds were being used to support trading activity on the securities markets. So the American authorities decided to close that gap, close that loophole through the Glass-Steagall provisions. An investment bank is not a bank. It's a securities firm that can only do securities business. A merchant bank is a hybrid institution in the middle, essentially an older English trade finance bank that emerged out of trade finance and foreign exchange activities. It was also providing commercial banking functions and then moves into securities activities later. So it does both. So you have a commercial bank is deposit only and lending, an investment bank is securities only, and a merchant bank can do both. The paper then looks at the international financial system, the historical development and evolution of this, the gold standard, Bretton Woods, petrodollars and debt crisis, Asia and Russian crisis and the credit crisis. It explains all of the main markets and considers the nature and operation of each of these in further detail. The money markets, the capital markets, the euro dollar markets, financial derivatives, currency markets, gold market, commodity markets and insurance markets. What I then separately do is this, I re-examine all of this, not in terms of the markets, but having regard to each of the particular types of products, instruments or claims in those markets. So it's reconsidering all of the different types of contracts involved, but structuring them in such a way that we get a parallel examination of the structure and nature of operation of these markets. So there's around five subheadings in each of these areas. So coinage and currency, credit and payment, public debt, corporate securities, risk and investment assets. With this, we can understand in a complete way the structure and operation of all of the core markets at the national and international level. The paper also looks at international banking, investment banking, international bonds, equities. This is the key activities carried out in the principal international financial centres with foreign exchange, financial derivatives, asset management, gold bullion, buying and selling, insurance and marine services. It then considers the historical nature and development of global investment banking, looking at investment banking business, which is principally based on equity and debt underwriting, market making and trading, asset management, advisory services, trade finance, foreign exchange and financial derivatives, prime brokerage. That's carrying out a range of services for hedge funds. Hedge funds need, for example, a custody service, a lending service, a collateral support service, foreign exchange service, possible risk management services with either interest rate hedges or foreign exchange hedges, a whole series of different types of support functions to allow them to carry out their specific activities, and then other types of financial action and involvement. I then look at the development of investment banking. I summarise the history of all of the key international investment banks, looking at this from the US, United Kingdom, European continent, and then Japanese perspective, and then parallel examination of the main international investment banking and institutions, referring again specifically back to the different types of crisis which was referred to before. We then construct a parallel examination of international commercial banking, and then we look at all of the key markets in further detail: loan markets, bond markets, project finance, securitization, and financial derivatives. All of this is provided by way of background in the key paper provided. The study pack then breaks this down into a series of core parts, and we examine each of these in further detail. We're principally going to be looking at the international markets more generally, then the loan market, the bond market, the euro note market, the commercial paper market, and stock market and exchanges. All of the key points, issues that arise in relation to each of these is considered in further detail in each part of the study pack. It reviews the object, purpose, and content of each of the classes. It sets out a series of pre-class objectives, post-class activities, and summarizes all of the reading in terms of core reading, optional reading, and then additional support reading as well. So all of the key issues examined are dealt with in the study pack and in the core document provided. On the system, we also have a series of other background papers, for example, on the structure and operation of the international banking and the euro-dollar markets. This explains the origin of the euro-dollar system in the post-Second World War period. After the Second World War, we had the Bretton Woods system. It was technically agreed about around 10 months before the end of the war. This was the Allied countries coming together in Mount Washington in Connecticut in the United States at the Bretton Woods Hotel. And what they were trying to do was to work out how they could create a new international financial system to apply after the Second World War. What they did was this: they established the International Monetary Fund, the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which becomes the World Bank, and then the World Bank Group, as well as a proposed International Trade Organization, an ITO. The development of the trade model was rejected by the French government, and I think by the American Congress as well. As an alternative and as a transitional measure, they adopted the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT, the GATT, instead, until that was later replaced by the World Trade Organization in 1985. The Bretton Woods system established the fixed exchange rate model after the Second World War. This was essentially a replacement dollar-based dollar-gold exchange standard, which replaced the earlier sterling dollar-based exchange standard. What happened was you fixed the value of the dollar to gold at $35 per ounce, and then all of the other countries in the world will fix their currencies to the dollar, subject to a fixed but adjustable exchange rate system. This then established the stability that allowed the massive expansion of markets in the post-war period after an initial period of recovery. The Bretton Woods system itself will last until 1971. The then American President Richard Nixon, in an announcement on the State of the Union, in particular after the Vietnam War and the additional costs that had been created and pressures on the American financial system, they adopt a new economic model. As part of that, he announces the closure of the gold window. This was on 15th August 1971. The effect of that meant that other countries could no longer exchange dollar bills for gold, the result being that terminated the fixed exchange rate system after the Second World War. This then led to very substantial interest rate and currency stability. There was a committee of 20 set up to try and design a new international system model, 1971, 72, 73. That failed, however, and we moved on to floating currencies from 1973 onwards, with all of this being confirmed by way of amendment to the International Monetary Fund articles at a Jamaica meeting in 1976. This is the beginning of the modern world. This represents the origin of the modern international financial system, where we have floating exchange rates, floating currencies, and very substantial amounts of other instability in the markets. This is specifically the origin of the financial derivatives markets, with a number of other key reforms and key developments. The background to the Eurodollar markets and the key developments and changes which occurred are all explained in this summary note. That includes, for example, the SWIFT system is the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication, SWIFT, set up in 1973 with 518 banks from 22 countries. This essentially manages the international payment system. Technically, we do not move money through SWIFT directly. SWIFT is simply a messaging service. If you want to transfer funds from New York to London, all that technically happens in practice is that the banks in New York will reduce the credit balance on a particular account. That corresponding amount will then be increased on the equivalent account system in London. It's just an adjustment of account balances. SWIFT is essentially a messaging service, a secure, cryptographically protected messaging service which allows the banks to communicate amongst each other. The actual transfer of funds only operates through adjustments in the account balances maintained by the banks in each of the key financial centres involved. There's also some interesting discussion of the nature of the Eurodollar system in terms of multiplier effects and leakage, with specific inclusion of some of the key famous documents that were produced, for example, Milton Friedman's paper on the Eurodollar market, some first principles, is referred to there, and some other parallel work, for example, on money creation in the Eurodollar market by Fred Klopstock. The paper then outlines the nature of Euro loans, the loan part of the market. It separately explains the background to the placement market under the Eurodollar markets. We have an interbank market where banks can lend money to each other, buy and sell money in each of the main Eurodollar currencies amongst themselves. The Eurodollar itself originally referred to the movement of dollar balances from America, principally New York, to London, so that they could be traded on the London markets. The term is then subsequently more generally used to refer to any international finance transaction which is denominated in a currency other than the currency of issuance of the transaction. So dollars in London would be euro dollars. Euros in London are euro dollars, but euros in Frankfurt or Paris would be domestic. Below the Eurodollar market, we have an interbank market, and then out of that, we will subsequently develop a loan market and then a separate bond market. All of that's explained in the paper, as well as the role of the key custodians in this market in the bond area. The investors almost never actually receive the paper certificates. In practice, these are almost always immobilized. The bonds, because they're very high value, because they can transfer title by delivery, in particular because they are negotiable, because of the security concerns that arise, what happened was from a very early stage, the market developed two key custodians. We had Euroclear in Brussels, we had Sedel in Luxembourg. Sedel would later become Clearstream. This market is still dominated by those two primary custodians. In practice, if there are any physical bonds produced either in a company, corporate, or a state sovereign deal, they will almost always be immediately immobilized and deposited with the custodians. In practice, much of this now is fully dematerialized, which means the certificates are only actually issued in an electronic form, but then again immediately deposited into the accounts of Euroclear and Clearstream. The paper also explains again the background to the Euro notes and commercial paper market, and then the beginning and origins, development and structure and operation of the financial derivatives market. I then provided a separate paper on the City of London and the importance of the City of London in terms of managing the key markets and acting as a core centre for many of these international financial facilities. The centre of the Eurodollar market is still London. Around 60% of all loan transactions are still carried out in London, with a major proportion of the bond market and the foreign exchange market. The paper simply reviews the origins, background development of the City of London. It reviews the key markets again, London market size, London market advantage, and then the historical evolution of this in terms of coffee houses, with many of the largest markets in the world beginning in coffee houses in the 1600s. I then provided a separate table which outlines the structure and operation of all of the key markets, so we can understand all of the core financial markets in the world by creating a simple division between the money, credit and banking markets on the left and then the capital markets on the right. Money markets consist of the primary money market, the secondary money markets, and then we have the domestic deposit and loan markets. Capital markets include the securities markets, the financial derivatives markets. We can also include alternative investment markets. These are the sort of high income, high return, high growth markets, high yield markets such as hedge funds, sovereign equity and sovereign wealth funds. We can also in the capital markets include currency markets, gold market, insurance markets and commodity markets. And then I've separately provided the values of all of the key markets involved. And we can understand the nature of all of this through this one table. What we can then do is look at the nature of the international loan finance in further detail, which I've provided a separate summary for. So we have the international loan market, loan structures, loan parties, loan facilities, the key documents involved, the key terms and provisions. So we have the loan obligations and conditions, we have the financial provisions, and we have the default provisions. All of that summarized on this table. What we can then do is we can look at the nature of a loan deal and we can contrast that with a bond deal, so we can outline all of the key parties in our international euro loan transaction and then contrast that in a bond deal. We can also build in here in red all of the key documents and then some other additional points on the legal nature of the debt obligations created. The core point that arises is simply that in a loan deal, what we will have is we will have a syndicate or group of banks which come together to make the facilities available. The objective is to spread risk. Each of the banks could provide the total amount, but they want in practice to spread the default risk that may arise. You will then have a number of members of the syndicate, anything between 2 and, on the Eurodollar deal, well over 100, 110, 114. You can also have more than one borrower. So we may have one company, a principal borrower, which will have up to possibly 9 separate subsidiaries. So for example, we could have 10 banks and 10 subsidiaries. What will then happen is this. You have a single loan agreement, although there will be multiple drawdowns under that loan agreement, and specifically under usually 2 separate facilities. You have a term loan, which is for a fixed duration, a fixed period in time. For example, 5, 10, 15, 20 years. You will also, that's the A facility. You will also have a B facility, which is a revolver. It's a revolving amount, usually a smaller amount, that you can draw down, repay, and then draw down again. If you repay the A facility, you cannot draw that down again. The point in practice that simply arises is this. If you have, for example, 10 banks in a syndicate, 10 borrowers as the borrowing group, you will immediately have 10 times 10 is 100 A facilities and B facilities. So at minimum, there's 200 loans. But what also happens in practice is you have extended drawdown periods called commitment periods or availability periods, so that the borrowers can draw down separately under each of the facilities over these separate commitment periods. So again, if there's 12 drawdowns on the A facility over, for example, a 1 to 2 year facility commitment period, that would be 120 up to 240 separate loans. And then on the B facility, it could be up to, for example, 240 or 2,400, and the total amount could be 2,600,400. But if we actually had full availability at all times and all borrowers were drawing down from all banks, the total technical amount could be around 26,400 under a single loan agreement. What that means is this: in law, you have multiple separate loan obligations, debt obligations, governed by a single consolidated standard set of integrated rights and obligations provisions as set out in the loan agreement. What I've then also done is on the bond deals, the bond transactions, we can summarise those. So we can understand the difference between the loan and bond transaction. We have the borrower, we have the lead bank, we have an agent bank, we have the syndicate. On the issuing bond transaction, we will have the issuer, which will be a corporate or sovereign provider of the basic securities, who'll issue the securities. You will have a lead bank that's going to purchase or undertake to ensure that all of the bonds, the securities, are purchased. If it's a large issue, we'll have a selling group as well as a syndicate group. If it needs additional management, there may be more than one manager, so we'll have a separate managing group as well. And the bond deal, if it's large, again, we may have a separate trustee. We will also have to have an agent. If there's a trustee, we have a paying agent. If there's no trustee, we have a fiscal agent, which also incorporates a trust element into the transaction so that the paying agent will hold amounts on trust on behalf of the investors. The investors are referred to at the bottom of this table, who could either be private or public purchasers. Again, we'll have local custodians and then the two key principal custodians, Euroclear and Clearstream. All of the bonds are essentially usually deposited with Euroclear and Clearstream, although subsequently in large numbers of transactions, and in particular more complex transactions, we can also use sub-custodians in different parts of the world, usually in each of the main financial centres. So, for example, where companies are borrowing lending and they're using the bonds as collateral support for that, we may have separate custodians involved as well. In terms of the issuance of the bonds themselves, I've summarised that on this table. Typically, we will use a 4-week period. So we have the original setting up, originating, marketing period. We then have the D-Day is the launch and syndication. So we have D-Day minus 7 is the pre-launch. We take the mandate letter, carry out the basic due diligence. With the D-Day launch and syndication, D-Day plus 14 will be the signing. D-Day plus 21 will be the closing. There's three key models we can consider: either a private placement, a preliminary prospectus offering, or an impact day offering. With a private placement, we're not selling to the general public. The managers will subscribe for the whole issue and they will then sell it on in the market themselves. They will have a large number of contacts that they are already in regular dealings with, and they will be able to place the bonds very quickly. If it's a larger issuance, we can either, and there's going to be a public offering, we can either have a preliminary prospectus offering or an impact day offering. With the preliminary prospectus, we're going to issue a red herring or pathfinder prospectus into the market to test opinion and appetite so that we can get the most appropriate price for the initial bonds themselves, the face value of the bonds. That can either be at discount, par or premium, as well as the coupon, the interest rate that's going to be attached. Very often, if we don't want to pay interest, we can pay at a discount, in what's called a deep discount. You can have deep discount securities which are issued without paying any interest, but what happens is they're issued at a substantial deduction against their face value, possibly 30%. Effectively, what happens is all of the interest that's due for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years is rolled up into that discount on the face value, so that the bond pays the full amount on maturity, but the investor only has to pay a substantially smaller amount on initial acquisition. You're effectively rolling up the interest. This can have substantial tax advantages for longer-term investors, in particular pension funds and other longer-term asset managers. With an impact day offering, you wait until a specific date. You then announce the offering to the market with the fixed price for the bonds and for the coupon. In practice, much of this will be dealt with through bond deals, which is effectively a private placement. The lead bank will undertake, under the subscription agreement referred to on the table before, to commit to purchase all of the bonds and ensure that they are sold on into the market. There's a number of other key terms we need to understand. For example, immobilisation, dematerialisation, disintermediation, demutualisation, consolidation. Immobilisation is, as we mentioned, all of the physical notes will be deposited with a custodian so that there's no risk of theft and passing on of title because they're bearer instruments and fully negotiable. Dematerialisation is where we issue the bonds and notes in an electronic format. Disintermediation is where we're going to have rolling shorter notes or commercial paper. What we don't want to do is to have to go back to the investment bank on each issuance. What we do is we set up a program. So under the program, the issuer can roll the release to the market of the notes of the commercial paper. So you disintermediate by removing the need for the investment bank to come back. Demutualization and consolidation, these are more to do with the exchanges or the clearinghouses in which we're dealing. Demutualization is whereby a stock exchange, which was previously a member's association, it was an unincorporated association, if it demutualizes, it takes the membership back off its owner members, it turns itself into a private or public limited company, and it sells shares back into the market, which may be on to its own market. This happened, for example, with the London Stock Exchange in the 1980s, as a result of which, while the Stock Exchange was formally responsible for both admission to listing and admission to trading, admission to listing was transferred to the Financial Services Authority as the key regulatory agency in the UK. Admission to listing is whereby you prepare all of the relevant documentation under local laws or European law to allow the making of a public offer. Admission to trading is where you become listed for being bought and sold on a specific stock market. So if you want a full public offering, very often you'll have need to get admitted to listing through now the FCA in the UK, as well as to become admitted to trading on a specific stock market or exchange, such as, for example, the London Stock Exchange or the New York Stock Exchange. Consolidation simply refers to the more recent practice which has occurred of stock markets and exchanges buying each other and merging to create former larger single entities. In terms of the legal nature of bonds, notes and commercial paper, how can we summarise these to contrast them, to distinguish them from a loan-based bank debt instrument and a security-based note or commercial paper? The subsequent history of the market was one of early development of the euro bond market, for example 20-year bonds on almost identical parallel terms to a 20-year loan. What then happened was you had these shorter instruments, the medium-term notes, as we said, 5, 10, 15 years, the euro notes possibly one up to 5, although they can go less than 1, and then the commercial paper up to 1. These shorter date instruments we can summarise legally as being short-dated, bearer anonymous instruments. They're unsecured, negotiable, they're issued usually free of withholding tax, they may be listed or unlisted, committed or uncommitted, and they're essentially all promissory notes in law. Committed or uncommitted goes back to the disintermediation point. That simply means, is the merchant bank obliged legally to purchase the notes or paper issued or not? Specifically, what will happen is a euro note will generally be committed, the commercial paper will generally be uncommitted. And with these basic summary tables then, we can understand the nature of the international euro loan and dollar market. All of this I then expanded in further detail in the papers. We have the specific paper on bond markets and on loan markets, and these are both available on the system. So we have loan finance and we have bond finance, and you have a full paper which looks at the nature of these in further detail. The euro loan market, historical development, loan facilities, loan structures, issue procedures, syndication, lead bank, agent bank liability, loan conditions and obligations, loan default, remedies, transfers, restructuring. On the bond market, we're looking at the historical development to the markets again, the structures, the issuance procedure, negotiability, clearing, and then the nature of euro bonds, and then other alternative bond structures and corporate bonds, including UK gilt stocks and bonds, US Treasury agency and municipal bonds, Japanese, German, other government securities, government bonds, foreign bonds, and other bond variants. So we can understand all of the market in terms of these core sets of provisions and detail. What we also need to then consider specifically is the potential liability of parties in each of these markets. The key issue that arises is that in the event that the borrower cannot repay the funds drawn down, or the issuer satisfy the redemption on the bonds, notes, or commercial paper, the question is where the banks can sue. Who can sue who? So we need to consider the issue of the liability of parties to one another. Specifically, what could happen is, for example, in a syndicated loan situation, the borrower defaults, so therefore the syndicate members may look to sue each other or sue the lead bank or sue the agent bank. And then again, in an bond situation, the investors may try to sue the lead bank or the agent bank or the trustee. In these cases, we need to consider the possible heads of liability and how we can limit or manage that liability in practice. I've dealt with all of this in a separate summary chapter made available. The core importance of this was powerfully demonstrated in an important case in 1976. That was the Ray Colquitronis Tanker Securities, whereby the issuing lead bank in that case agreed to settle a claim with the other syndicate banks, who had alleged that because of its experience and professional standing in the markets, it was an expert in international finance and in assessing and promoting relevant participations. In that particular case, European American Banking Corporation, EABC, had set the syndicate up, and it agreed to repay all of the funds lost by the other banks in that particular case. That confirmed, demonstrated the potential liability issues that can arise and the need to try and manage this in practice. In terms of being able to deal with this, what we can do is consider this with regards to the heads of liability, how we can limit that possible liability in terms of what we call limited duty or basis clauses, and then how we can otherwise limit liability legally in law, legitimately, properly, and then separately, the limitations on our ability to limit liability. So that's the controls on excluding liability, and then we can look at the remedies. In terms of heads of liability, we have common law misrepresentation, so we can have innocent, negligent and fraudulent misrepresentation. We also have statutory misrepresentation under Section 2(1) of the Misrepresentation Act 1967. And then we have statutory deceit under the Theft Act, Section 19. Statutory misrepresentation is very important. It becomes a key area of claim. What essentially happens in practice is that the Misrepresentation Act reverses the traditional burden of proof. If a party suffers loss as a result of misrepresentation, it only has to prove the loss. The other party then assumes, bears the obligation to prove, to establish by way of defence, that it had reasonable belief on the truth or veracity of the statement made. So what we effectively do is we reverse the burden of proof in practice. It's a very important area of potential liability, which can arise in almost any legal transaction, any legal situation. We also possibly have agency liability issues, fiduciary duty issues, and regulatory liability. We can control, constrain liability in practice initially and most simply by having limited duty clauses. If we limit the scope of a party's duty, the other party cannot then say it breached that duty because it wasn't under any initial duty in the first place. So simply by clarifying and narrowing the scope of possible responsibility and function, we can limit liability. So we can have no duty clauses, information supply clauses, own credit assessment clauses, no reliance clauses, no fiduciary duty clauses. These are also called basis clauses, and I've given you some recent notes from the Encyclopedia of Banking on important case law in this area, which began to qualify some of these protections, but then re-established the general original positions. We've then also got limitations of liability. How can we exclude liability in practice? We can have direct, express, contractual exclusion clauses, and this is perfectly legal and legitimate in law, and there's a series of cases, Photo Productions and others, which Swiss Atlantic, which confirm this. We can also consider set-off, and then the distinction between set-off and netting. We can also think about estoppel clauses, indemnity, and contributory negligence. Estoppel, there's various different types of estoppel that can arise. What we're essentially doing is we're establishing that by the conduct of another party, they've essentially agreed or acquiesced in a certain set of situations which prevent them from claiming otherwise. Indemnity is whereby even if loss arises, we can still claim indemnity against another party for the loss that arose, that was caused. Contributory negligence is where the court considers the conduct of each of the parties and it attributes fault proportionately, possibly 50-50, maybe 60-40, 70-30. We then have to consider possible exclusions on liability, and we can do that through two sets of key statutory provisions. We have unreasonableness under the Unfair Contract Terms Act. We also have what were the Consumer Contract Regulations, 1989. Those were revised and amended and now incorporated into the Consumer Rights Act, 2015. Because these only apply in consumer-related transactions, we do not have to consider this further in large international finance transactions because we're dealing in large professional, national and international governments, corporate bodies and financial institutions. We still, however, have to consider reasonableness under the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977, which is specifically imported in relation to misrepresentation and exclusion clauses under the Misrepresentation Act 1967. I've explained, summarised all of this in further detail in the table, as well as provided a list of all of the key cases in this area, such as, for example, Springwell, PK, DPAC, IFC versus Goldman Sachs, and some of the other core decisions which have been issued. The courts have generally supported the bank's position and confirmed the full enforceability, legitimacy, veracity, all of the provisions referred to above. In the event that we have a default, we have to specifically consider possible five remedies. We can have suspension or withholding of further advance. We can have cancellation of the obligation to lend under the facility. We can accelerate repayment. We can rescind the document. And we can sue for damages or breach of contract or tort. In practice, the key remedy is the threat of rescission. That's why drafting conditions precedent, representations and warranties and covenants are very important. What we're trying to do, and this is covered in the loan chapter in detail, including in the footnotes with the relevant case law provided, is we're trying to elevate representations to warranties and then representations and warranties to conditions so that we can have the remedy of threat of rescission, because that then puts the banks in a very powerful position to negotiate with the borrowers. In any specific situation, the banks will not want to rescind and sue. They want the borrower to survive so they can still claim some recovery. It is, however, a very powerful negotiation tool to be able to threat the exercise of a rescission power, so that puts the banks in a stronger position to manage any rescheduling or restructuring of the debt. We can then consider this in terms of some of the other key issues and points which can arise in practice. When we're looking at some of the key clauses in both the loan deal and the bond deal, we need to consider how the interest rate is calculated. This was principally dealt with before on the basis of the London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR. LIBOR was used in almost all international finance transactions in all of the key financial centres across the world. Difficulty arose whereby Barclays Bank admitted to slightly manipulating its LIBOR estimations during the global financial crisis. It wasn't trying to commit fraud in any way. It wasn't trying to benefit itself in any way. It was just trying to calm the markets and prevent a run on Barclays, which could have then led to further instability in the UK financial system. Because of the concerns that arose with regards to the voluntary nature and the expectation-based operation of the LIBOR model, it was decided to replace that with different, new, more secure forms of what we call IBORs, interbank offered rates. The LIBOR model initially used to operate by having between 14 and 16 banks report every morning the expected cost that they thought it would cost, they would have to pay to borrow funds on an overnight basis. So it was based on expectation. We had between 14 and 16 quotes. We would remove the top two and the bottom two and then take an average of the other quotes in the middle. That was then released to the market as the daily LIBOR rate. I think it was at 10 o'clock in the morning by the British Bankers Association, although responsibility for that was then transferred to the Intercontinental Exchange, ICE. Because of the open, voluntary, personal subjective nature of the system, it was decided that that would be removed and replaced by more formalised models. So we need to consider the movement from the earlier LIBOR system, how LIBOR was calculated, to different new models based on alternative IBOR systems, and then some of the specific new options which are available. I've already mentioned in Europe we have ESTR, in America SOFR, secured overnight rate. We also have TIBOR in Tokyo, we have SIBOR in Shanghai, and we have in Mumbai, we have MIBOR, and another series of other types of rate. The objective is to try and create a more secure and accurate estimation of the actual costs of borrowing in any particular market. In the United Kingdom, the specific model that's been developed through the Bank of England is SONIA. That's the sterling overnight interest rate. This is managed by the Bank of England, and all I've provided in this note is a review of the key elements of this, how it's calculated, how it's governed, and how it's reported to the markets. There are some other issues that arise in terms of key provisions, such as with regards to material adverse change clauses. I deal with this in the loan chapter, although there's some other interesting points which have arisen, especially with regards to case law in this area. So it's possible to do some extra work on this to understand how this comes together in practice with regard to the nature of MAC clauses and the drafting of clauses. I've provided some specific examples on the system again. This is dealt with in the, which referred to in the bond chapter and dealt with in the loan chapter in further detail. It's also considered in other materials provided. I've made available some of the sample clauses that can be used, and what we can also do is consider how these operate in practice and other aspects of the legal remedies that would arise. What I've also done is on the system, I've provided a separate note on negative pledge clauses. I Again, looking at these in further detail, these tend to be amongst the most important of the specific covenants that arise in practice, so we need to look at this in further detail. It's dealt with in the chapter, but we can build in further more recent case law in this area. The other key set of provisions to note is the cross-default. The core issue that arises in practice is that each bank wants to protect its own position. The problem is that if it calls early default, that will then trigger cross-default in all of the other outstanding obligations that the borrower has entered into. That could then, in practice, and will usually lead to the insolvency of the institution, so therefore the bank will not receive anything. We need to consider the timing and triggering of cross-default clauses for that reason. It also raises issue to do with pari passu and sharing clauses in the loan documentation. If we exercise the clause, if we try to sue, we're under an obligation to share because we've had a superficial surfy benefit that other members of the syndicate haven't received. So legally we are required under the loan documentation to pay that to the Asian bank. The Asian bank will then divide that in proportion to the commitments of the lenders and repay it to them. There are, however, exemption provisions at the end of the standard clauses, usually incorporated, and we can see that in particular in the Loan Market Association documentation. There's specific provisions there which deal with the sharing clause. At the end of that, it's clause 28. At the end of that, if one of the banks notifies all of the other banks that it is taking action, if it invites them to participate but they decline to do so, if the bank does receive funds, it can retain those in practice. So what we're then doing is we're highlighting other key aspects of the core types of provisions that will arise in practice that can either be dealt with through negotiation at an early stage in the drafting stage, or through later negotiation in the event of possible or impending default. We have to think about how these documents come together as living, dynamic sets of rights and entitlements that will actually govern relations and determine the legal effects and implications of particular types of events and factual structures. What we're then doing is we're trying to anticipate the types of problems that may arise in practice and how specific clauses are relevant and how these may assist deal with particular aspects of that. I've summarised some of the core clauses that have to be reviewed in the event of disruption types of events. So we have, for example, the recalculation of interest clause in the LMA. This is 8 and 10.2. We have possible illegality provisions, prepayment and cancellation, increased cost clauses, possible indemnities, mitigation and indemnity, and amendment costs, possible guarantees, and a number of other provisions. What we're trying to do is to anticipate difficulties that could arise and how we can resolve these through the agreement and inclusion of very well drafted legal provisions up front in the standard documentation used. What this then does is it allows us to protect our client's interest as well as to ensure that the transactions go through initially and that they can operate in practice in a stable and effective manner on a longer term basis. That is the overall objective of finance law and of international finance law documentation. We're trying to guarantee or confirm that the transactions operate as intended and that the rights and entitlements, interests of all of the parties are protected insofar as possible, specifically in accordance with the allocation rules that we will incorporate into the clauses drafted. And through clever, intelligent, informed drafting, we can protect all relevant parties' interests.